Hello, and welcome to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Sharicana. We invite you to join us on Thursdays at 8 p.m. for an engaging exchange with us and our special guest as we cover various topics regarding history, genealogy, and your personal family history stories. Hello, I'm Janice Gilliard.
And I'm Sharicana Feliciano. Welcome to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Sharicana. Thank you for joining us. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Today, we are joined by our guest, Darius Brown.
Darius M. Brown is a research assistant genealogist at the International African American Museum in Charleston, South Carolina. He has more than 6 years' experience in genealogy with an emphasis on researching enslaved African Americans in the Lowcountry of South Carolina. He has researched several lines of his family into the colonial period and has reconstructed the enslaved population at several plantations, including Old Fort, Otaheite, Blue Mud, and the Blake Plantations, which were located in Beaufort, Charleston, and Colleton counties, South Carolina.
Mr. Brown has conducted genealogical research on the enslaved families in Dr. Etta Fields Black's forthcoming book, Cumbie, Harriet Tubman, The Cumbie River Raid and Black Freedom During the Civil War, Oxford Press. He is also featured on a drive and tour app called Free and Equal, available on Apple and Google Play Store. Mr. Brown is currently finishing his bachelor's degree in organizational management at the College of Charleston. Welcome to Speak On It, Darius Brown.
Thank you for the introduction, and hello to everyone that's tuning in.
Awesome. So Darius, thank you for joining us. And I had the wonderful opportunity to meet you at the International African American Museum. So in your book, you noted that you attended family reunions on a regular basis and recall your great-grandfather recounting the names of your ancestors. Oral history can play a major role in family history. How important do you think family reunions are when it comes to learning about your family?
Yeah, so growing up throughout my life, I was always going to a family reunion, whether it was on my mom's side or on my dad's side, I was always at a family reunion. And majority of the family reunions, someone was talking about family history. And so I would get family history at the family reunions or just sitting on the porch with my grandparents or my great-grandparents. But a lot of stuff that I heard about my elders or my ancestors came from my elders. And so they passed it down to me. And so that's pretty important because once you start doing genealogy research, oral history can help you a lot. You know, sometimes we don't always have paper evidence, but that oral history can take you back another generation or two. If you got it from your elders. And so that plays a big role in my book because I feature a lot of oral history that I heard.
How old, let's see, what's the youngest that you remember, like maybe your first one attending? Like, were you 7, 8? You know, I'm asking because I remember.
It probably was somewhere around there.
7 or 8, wow. Where do you think that you were interested then or it came later?
I think I always was interested in hearing something about the family history because it was interesting that I would hear my elders talk about.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah, you know, it's the family reunion tradition is something that I hope that it stays around. I can't always tell. I can't always have a good sense of whether or not like we're retaining it as much or if it's going kind of, you know, out of style or not, whatever the case may be, I hope that we keep it because it is so important. In fact, 2020, had it not been for the pandemic, I would have been at a family reunion I was really looking forward to. And I don't know, I feel like as a, you know, Southerners would call us Yankees, but us Northerners, Black Americans, us in reunions, sometimes, you know, it gets a little harder because a lot of it tends to be in the South and it's the traveling and so forth. But this one I was really looking forward to. It would have been my first time actually in South Carolina. And this is my Chitty line. And I was really excited about that one because, to your point, that's where a lot of the oral history is shared. That's where you get to talk to the older relatives, and you get that family history, those stories that you can't get otherwise, you know. So it really is a treasure, and I hope that, you know, we as a people, no matter where we are in the United States, keep that tradition alive. So the title of your book is At the Feet of the Elders: A Journey into a Low Country Family History. How did you get involved in researching your family history? You talked about the reunions and so forth, and what inspired you to write your book?
So I got started with genealogy after I saw an Ancestry commercial. That's pretty much how I got started. And so I decided that I would take the DNA test. And so I would go on YouTube and watch people, they would make the videos and they would guess how much African they would be and stuff like that. So I was doing the same thing. And so I guess that I would be somewhere around 80 to 85% African. And so I was taking into consideration the research on what they say the average African American is somewhere around 80 to 85%
Right.
African. And then sometimes it varies depending on the region. But when I got my test results back, it said I was 98%. And then I went,
Wow. That's high. That is
That's
high.
very
Yeah,
high.
that's very
So I
high.
went on a quest trying to find out, well, who was that person that made that journey from Africa, to Charleston, South Carolina? Because, Beaufort is just an hour away from Charleston. And so I know my enslaved ancestors would at least pass through that port, when they were brought here. And so that's what kind of got me started. And so once I got my results back, it said I was 98% African. And then I said, well, I might as well just research my family history. And at first, this woman by the name of Kimberly Morgan,
Yes. Yeah, we know her. She was a guest before. Friend to the show, for sure.
she got me started. And so she was helping me at first. And I remember I gave her the names of my family members that I knew from off the top of my head. And I believe it was like a few days later, and she had traced my tree back, I believe to like my third great grandparents. And I was like, well, this seemed to be a little easy. I might as well just do this myself. And so that's how I got started researching my family history. And that was in 2017.
So now we're in trouble already because Kimberly Morgan is the truth. I found my first Civil War ancestor, U.S. Colored Troop, Smart Lewis, maybe 6, 7 years ago. And I made a post on Our Black Ancestry. And Kimberly Morgan saw my post, got up the next morning and went to the Beaufort National Cemetery, took pictures, video, gave me all the history, and then researched my ancestor and sent all of this information, and I was blown away. So that was my introduction to Kimberly Morgan, and we become online friends ever since. So it's so cool that, you know, we have that connection and she was able to help you. And I think it's fascinating, though, circle back to your response, that you got involved from an ancestry commercial.
Yeah, it's pretty
That
unique.
sounds like it would be nice for them to hear that. It's like, oh, well, let's, you know, bring him on for an advertisement, you know, because I don't hear that often, that, oh, that's the way I got started. That's on ancestry.com, ancestry commercial.
It was an Ancestry commercial. And so I said, you know what? I'm gonna just take this test and see how much African I am.
What area, or region or people made up the majority of your African ancestry?
So at the time, I believe it was like Nigeria and Cameroon, Congo. Then it was Senegal and Mali, and some other countries, well, other regions at the time.
All right.
So, Darius, the resilience of your ancestors was a recurring theme in your book. I was impacted while reading about Diana, noting that she didn't know how old she was, and her describing that she and her husband, Cuffy, were married by a preacher long before the Civil War. Which ancestor stands out the most for you as an example of resilience? And I hope you're not offended by that question because most people are like, well, all of them, but we can't talk about all of them. So if you'd like to share about maybe two of them and the impact maybe that they made on you or the ones that stand out the most for you.
In my book, I use a lot of Civil War pension files, and that's because I have nearly over 30 relatives that fought in the Civil War. Seven are my direct ancestors, and the rest are cousins and uncles and in-laws. But in the pension file, Diana says, I don't know how old I am. I'm old enough. And many enslaved people, they didn't know their ages exactly as we do because, they didn't really keep up with that kind of stuff. And then you would notice that on the census, many times people's ages don't always line up. With Diane, and you see that a lot everywhere in my family. People ages aren't always lining up in the documents. Time and time after again inside the pension files, they all say, I don't know how old I am, but I think I'm 50 years old. I think I'm 55 years old. Diana and Cuffy, those ancestors are, yeah, they do represent resilience because, they were enslaved. They would shuffled around on the plantation owner, his three plantations. Buford technically sits on Port Royal Island. Many people just don't use that terminology no more, but he had two plantations on Port Royal Island. Otaheite is pretty much in the community that my family still lives in now, where I grew up at. And then he had Old Fort Plantation. That was the main plantation on the opposite side of the island. And then Blue Mud Plantation was a rice plantation. It was on the Savannah River. But he would move them around on his plantations at will, depending on where work was needed. So in the pension file, Cuffy, he talks about how they were at Savannah River when they were married. I mean, he says that they were married by a white preacher. But on the Savannah River, Diana talks about that she had eight or nine children, but she said some died before they had names. They've done studies on the Savannah River plantations, and the studies show that I believe 90% of the children were dying from Asiatic cholera and stuff like that, and then diseases that were pretty rampant on rice plantations. And so I believe that she might have lost many of her children when they were located at Blue Mud Plantation on the Savannah River. Another, I guess, well, she's not a direct ancestor, but she's a relative of mine. And that's for my Blake Plantation research, but her name is Penda Blake. But Penda Blake, I heard about her from my great grandmother when I was younger. She said that Penda Blake was a cousin of ours, but she didn't know exactly how, we were related to her. But I will always find Penda Blake and all of the people who were enslaved by the Blake family in their pension files. She will always testify. But I just gravitated towards her, I don't know. It's like a, I don't know how to explain it, but it
Can
was
you
a.
give an example of what she was testifying about, maybe, like one of the cases or what she was sharing?
For me, I was trying to reconstruct the enslaved population, just trying to find out who was the people that were enslaved by the Blake family, particularly Arthur Blake. So he enslaved my third great grandmother and her parents and so on back. She would testify and say, I know this person all my life. We were slaves of the same master. We had the same master, Arthur Blake. And the thing is, it's not just her, but many of the people, they talk about how they were born on the Cumbie River. And the thing is, laid out in my book, but they were actually moved from the Cumbie River, and then they would move 100 miles away to labor on the Santee River, because Arthur Blake, he purchased a new plantation there. These people were separated during slavery from their family members. Once Arthur Blake, his father was named Daniel Blake Sr. And once his estate was divided up amongst his children, Arthur Blake, he decided to take all the people from Cumbie River and move them to the Santee River. But I use genetic genealogy to help put back some of those, families again, because all the descendants will always show up on my DNA matches or my grandmother DNA matches. I will look at their family trees, and these people entire their entire family trees will go back to that one plantation. So I know that we had a common ancestor on the Blake plantations. Those ancestors were pretty resilient. Yeah. And then that's the only side of my family where I have the ship records.
Wow, you
You've
got some robust records there.
been putting it down with this genealogy
I'm
to
telling you.
6 years. Like, you've done a lot. And I mean, to be inspired from a commercial and then to take it and run with it and You know, I'm thankful that you and Kimberly connected because now you're on fire and writing a book and all of this good stuff, working at the museum and like, wow. So I'm
I was
impressed.
looking at the name of your ancestor, Cuffy, and I was wondering if it made me think Kofi, which is a African name, a Ghanaian name. Do you know if it perhaps is a Anglicized version of Kofi?
Yep. So, and basically in South Carolina, they did a good job of retaining African names. So you would notice once you start researching enslaved people, you will see a lot of African names from a lot of regions. But the Akan, their naming system survived in the New World, rather it was Jamaica or Barbados. Their entire naming system survived. So I
By the
have
days of the week, yeah.
I have about five ancestors named Cuffy, several named Afi. We say Afi here, but I believe the correct pronunciation is Afi. But yeah, I believe that we do have some type of Akan ancestry on that side, because I also remember my great grandmother talk, I mean my great grandfather talking about a Nancy. And Nancy is, the trickster spider guy from the Akan tales and stuff like that.
Yes.
So
That's amazing.
I'm sorry. So you mentioned the name Afi. That's my son's middle name, and it means one who is spiritual. And then I was in the book I was reading, there was the name Tina, and I've seen it spelled different ways, and I have an ancestor named Tina. And then also I have an ancestor that was named Monday as well as Friday, and then one July. You know, now July is something totally different, but
Same.
that, and then the other one I wanted to ask about was, have you ever seen Bina, Bina, or Benah? Because I think Brian Sheffy was talking about this during one of his presentations, and he said, if you see that name, that's, and they have another name, then Bina or Bina is the African name. And when he was doing the presentation, I was like losing it because I do have an ancestor. She's my second great grandmother, and her name was Eugenia. But then in some records, you see her listed as Baina, Baina, and I'm going, that's got to be what it is. At least I want to believe that that was her African name.
I have several ancestors with African name, and Bina is one of them.
Wow.
Look at that. Look at
And
that.
the woman that I just spoke about before, Penda Blake, that is a West African name, from that Senegambia region. And so her name is African. Her brother was named Sambo. And so here in America, when we think of Sambo, we think of some derogatory,
Negative, yeah.
and then then the name Sambo is sometimes used differently depending on the region. So I believe, like in Louisiana, sometimes they use the name Sambo to denote mixed ancestry. But in South Carolina, it seemed like the name Sambo is coming from the Fulani name. Sometimes they spell the Sambo there, and then there's an A, Samba or something like that. But her brother was named Sambo. But I will always notice, on the Blake plantations, those names repeat. Fatima, Sambo, Penda, they just keep repeating and stuff. And that's because the slave owner was actually buying people from that region. And then you also have cousins there in Senegal from the Wolof tribe. And then I got one of my great uncles to take the test. He was 100% African. But he has like 11 cousins in Guinea Conakry, Fulani tribe.
So at the museum, they have the wall with the names, and I saw a Friday. I saw, I kept seeing the name Hester, which I have several in the line. I saw, I believe I saw Tina, and I was just really like overwhelmed because it's like, well, it was this a naming pattern? Are these the same people? So I think just like I have about 10 Edward Crosses in my line that they kept renaming their children. They didn't want the names to die, I think was my point. And having them up on the black wall like that, it just really like it was striking to me to see some names that I recognize. And even if they weren't directly connected to me in a way, I just feel like they are. Just the power in a name. And again, that resilience in seeing names handed down, to me, that speaks to, oh, we're going to keep the, you may enslave us, but we're going to keep that legacy alive in some way. So.
And, it's very interesting to see the ways that our ancestors retained certain practices. And when you mention these names of the names that are after the days of the week, you know, Monday and Friday, I makes me wonder if perhaps that became the sort of U.S. colonized version of the, you know, Ashanti or Akan naming practice of the days of the week, right? And maybe instead of saying Akosua, you know, now it's Sunday. So that's something to, you know, there's a lot in the name for sure.
Yeah, and then I also have a direct ancestor named Friday Blake. Yeah.
Oh wow. I like, okay, Friday. We have a friends of the of our genealogy group in Jersey. If these walls could talk, our ladies down there in South Jersey, their ancestor was a Friday as well. Friday Trueheart, I believe.
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah,
so
these stones could talk. Yeah, I'm
if
with you.
these stones could talk, yes. If these walls could talk, it's a completely different movie.
I was like, well,
If
no,
these
that's not gonna
stones
talk.
could
It'll
talk.
listen, it, but really, if the walls could talk and the stone, if
That's
everything
right.
could talk, if
That's
everything could talk.
right.
So, and London was a name. London was another name that was there, and it's just like,
I have an ancestor named London Brown. Yeah. And
I
so
like that. I
we
like
may
that.
need to have a conversation, a different
Yeah.
one, but okay.
They introduced the those European city names. So you would see Lancaster or Lancashire and London and
Bonaparte,
Somerset.
parts the Somerset.
And then
I
I
like
have
that.
a chart in there about with the African names from the Blake plantations, yeah, in my book.
London Brown, though, I don't know, it has a nice ring to it. I like that. So Darius, please share with our listeners a little bit about the colonial research connected to your family. And we're asking this question because a lot of people think that it's not possible. It's impossible to do this.
Yeah, so once I started to order the pension files and stuff like that, I would notice that many of my ancestors were enslaved by some of the prominent families in South Carolina, and it's actually quite shocking to me. I mean, it's not shocking, but it's kind of shocking.
Right.
So on my mom's side, some of my ancestors were enslaved by a man named General Charles Coatsworth Pinckney. And then later on in my research, I ended up finding out that on my dad's side, I had ancestors that were enslaved by his brother, Thomas Pinckney. But the Pinckney family, they kept detailed records and stuff of the enslaved people. So they had like plantation journals. Thomas Pinckney, his son is named after his brother. But he had like a rare plantation journal, and he listed all the people on the plantation and he gave their ages, their names, where they were born. And then he did something quite different. There was a section called character, and he would put down that the person had good character or whatever. But he would put down, you know, like, what is this person's parents' names, you know, their siblings and all that. And so I was able to trace, like, on my father's side to the early 1700s, because my family was recorded in the Pinckney Plantation journals for six generations. So that's like
Wow.
from 1840 all the way to the early 1710s. And so that kind of research, it is possible. Once you find out who the slave owner family is, you have to research that family just as much as your own family.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. Thank
Right,
you.
Dennis, you say that a lot. Yep.
Because a lot of people don't. They don't want to, or they're like, I don't want to have anything to do with it. And I keep stressing, I forget, it may have been Nika that said that, you know, research them, their fan, the enslaver's family as much as you would research your own, because their history when they were enslaved will be wrapped up and written
Intertwined with
somewhere, because they,
theirs.
you always kept track of your property and your money. And that's a harsh reality, or it's very harsh to see your ancestors listed with tools or the bed or the horses, whatever. I think the first thing that time I saw that, I was like, I'm not angry. Then I was like, I don't really know how I feel. And so then the anger turns into, you know what? Empowerment. Like, I will tell your story. You're more than a tool and being listed next to a horse, or being given permission to go work somewhere. Permission to, when I, you know, controlling when I wake up, controlling when I go to bed, controlling who I can't even be with. You know, I have one ancestor that's listed in a will, and you can see the ancestor keeping them together. It's my fifth great grandmother keeping. She married him, or was with him cohabitating, as they would say, which I can't stand either. But how he kept them together. And just to think that, okay, well, did they want to be together? You know, I said somebody could do something even on that, you know, where you're enslaved and somebody, you know, matches you up with somebody. You know, what did that feel like? God only knows, you know. So very interesting. But we are in those records, and it's worth it to look and not get stuck at, oh, well, I could only 1870. No. We're in a lot more records than just records from 1870 or wills from that time period. So I tell people, you know, folks say, well, you know, how do I start with? Yes, there's methodology to genealogy and doing it the right way. But I'm at a point now where I'm like, look at everything, all of the census records, you know, just being maybe focusing on one person at a time, but don't limit yourself to a time period. Don't limit yourself to a location. So.
Darius, can you also, I mean, you've mentioned the pension file, the Civil War pension records like twice. And personally, I'm still on a natural high because I finally secured the Civil War pension file for my ancestor. And I got the runaround. It took a while to get it. I got it. It's very long. It's 279 pages. Can you share? And I find that outside of the genealogy space, I don't know if people fully understand, you know, how important these records are. And granted, most of our listeners are probably going to be folks who are interested in genealogy. But if you could just share with our listeners the importance of Civil War pension files and the types of information you were able to find in those files.
Yeah, so the Civil War pension files, those records are like, they're so important because you get firsthand testimony from the people themselves. And so I was able to find more people who was enslaved on the same plantation as my ancestors because they would testify for each other. So, you know, many of the soldiers, they were married during slavery. They were formerly enslaved. They didn't have a marriage certificate to prove that one Saturday night that they jumped the broom or something like that. So now you have five witnesses testifying for you, and they all saying, you know, we knew this person all our lives. We had the same master, or we lived on adjoining plantations. I saw when they were married one Saturday night. And then I've seen some pension files where descendants of slave owners or the slave owners themselves testify for the person. This person used to belong to my father. But I don't remember his name being William. His name was Billy. Like, so you know, it's kind of nuanced and and stuff like that. And so the pension files are very important because, and then the people, sometimes they talk about their parents, talk about their siblings and stuff like that. That's genealogical information, especially if you never knew the person's parents. And so you hear them saying it themselves, you know, my father was named Friday and my mother was named Eliza. So those records are very helpful when it comes to African-American research, genealogical research. Yeah.
That's right. Thank you for breaking that down.
It's really like in my opinion, and I think, Chiricana, this plays into like you feeling that you're on a high from receiving your ancestor civil, especially all that you went through to get that information, thinking, and Chiricana kept being told, oh, well, we don't have it. Then she gets it. And then even when she gets it, they still send something to say, oh, well, we don't have it. Okay, mm-hmm. So wait a minute, what's going on here?
So left hand was not knowing what the right hand was doing.
So it's like for me with genealogy, anything that I'm reading about my ancestors or really anybody's ancestors, I can research anybody's family, read, you know, intriguing stories about families. And it is literally to me, I feel like I'm really taking a step back in time and trying to feel and embrace what they may have experienced, you know? So I think it's just powerful when we do family history. And I saw a quote today, and you know, I'll look it up before we're done, about how our ancestors are with us. They really are with us. And so it's not about being spooky, spiritual, anything like that. But the fact that you're here is because they were resilient. The fact that you're here, they didn't give up, and you wouldn't be you without your parents, without your grandparents. And that DNA is living on the inside of you. And that's why I really feel that when we do this work and we just latch onto an ancestor and we can't go, or we get those nudgings and all, to me is so powerful. And I just feel that it's their DNA speaking. The DNA that's within us, it's them speaking very loudly. Like, keep looking for me, keep telling my story. So as we move forward, you noted that you have approximately 30 ancestors that fought in the Civil War. And they, and I thought this was really cool. And they received their stars and stripes at the first reading of the Emancipation Proclamation. And Kimberly Morgan was the one that she, my ancestor, Smart Lewis, was there. And she's the one that told me that, oh, he was there when they were reading. I was just like, that is just mind blowing. Not only that, I have ancestors, and hopefully we can get to that as well. I have ancestors that were up north in Connecticut that came south to teach the people at Port Royal. One ancestor, Samuel G. Cross, was one of those teachers. There was an organization that he was a part of that was established for that person. So he was a Freedmen's Bureau teacher, and he was in Beaufort. So on the 1870 census, talking about records giving you information, it lists that he's actually Indian, which my family kept saying forever. They actually put that one on the census record, his race on the census records. I was like stunned by that. And that he was a teacher, that he was from Connecticut. And I was just blown away. And the reason he was in Beaufort was because he was a Freedmen's Bureau teacher. So with all of that, can you share with our listeners a little about two of your ancestors that were U.S. colored troops? One or two, or, you know.
So I guess I can talk about my ancestor Isaiah Brown, and maybe my ancestor Luke Wright. And so Isaiah Brown, that's my third great grandfather on my father's side. I heard about Isaiah from my great grandfather. That was his grandfather, and he actually lived with Isaiah when he was younger. Like going back to earlier, the oral history and stuff like that. I remember when I was younger. I will always go sit on the porch with my great grandparents. Majority of the times, whenever the adults would be around, children would be around, and so we would be somewhere else playing around and stuff like that. But it would be times where there was no one of my age around, and my grandmother, she would make me sit on the porch, and she told me, don't say a word. But she never told me that I couldn't listen though, and so
I like that. I
listen.
like
Don't say a
that.
word, but she couldn't tell me. Oh
Never
my
said
gosh. Never said I couldn't
I
listen.
couldn't listen.
Never said I couldn't listen. And I
A
remember that
loophole.
day, my great grandfather, he was saying, my grandfather, he fought in the Civil War. His name was Isaiah Brown. And then I remember his wife, my great grandmother, she said, my great grandfather, he fought in the Civil War too. His name was Morris McNeil. And Isaiah Brown, he was in the 1st South Carolina. That was one of the first black regiments in South Carolina. He was a sergeant and a private. But it's kind of funny because this is my great grandfather on my father's side. So my mom and my dad are from the same community. It's a small community. Everybody know each other. Everybody went to the same school. If you get in trouble, this person's gonna tell your parents, and everybody know each other. So it's a well-connected community. But my ancestor Luke Wright, he's my fourth great grandfather on my mother's side. And the thing is, him and Isaiah were actually tent mates.
Wow.
They say it inside the, they said in the pension files that they were tent mates. And so I always find out that that was kind of interesting. And then the thing is, their grandsons, which is my great grandfather, and then my other great grandfather on my mother's side, they were good friends. And I still wonder to this day, did they know that their grandfathers were tent mates in the Civil War?
And
That
then
is
here
so
you come
cool.
telling their story.
Yeah.
Man, that's pretty cool. So, archival records were used to shed light on your ancestors arriving from Africa. What are the records that were used, and can you share about this aspect of your book?
Right. So, one of the records that I did use, it's available resource online, but it's called slavevoyages.org. Basically, you will see all the ships that were coming from Africa, whether it came to the to Charleston or Virginia or something like that, even the Caribbeans. But one of the slave traders from Charleston, his name was Henry Lawrence, and he had a firm called Austin and Lawrence and Appleby, and then at one point it was just Austin and Lawrence. But his account book survived to this present day, and it's digitized online by Yale University. And so I always knew that my ancestors were enslaved by the Blake family. I could remember that from when I was younger. My great grandmother, I remember she mentioning that our family was enslaved by the Blake family. And that was one of the reasons why I would always listen to family history, because, well, the oral history, because it was kind of interesting that the names of slave owners were passed down. And so when I was reading the pension files and stuff like that, I was like, I heard this before. It was like jogging my memory.
Right.
One of the earliest ancestors of the Blake family, he's actually an uncle of Arthur Blake. His name was Daniel Blake. And he was purchasing a lot of people from Henry Lawrence because he's recorded in Henry Lawrence's account book. So he was buying people from Sierra Leone. He was buying people from
Oh.
Gambia River. He bought people from the Congo. You can tell that he purchased people from Ghana because several of the men, some of their names were Kwamina, Kwaku.
Wow.
So you can tell that he was buying people from there. And then me and other descendants, we have relatives still in those places on our DNA matches. But those account books, they tell you where the ship was coming from. Then they can tell you, so they have it categorized, men, women, boys, and girls. It lets you know how many men that the person purchased. Same thing with the women, boys, and girls. And so I was using that record particularly because I knew that this was a direct connection. I know that this is the man, and then we have relatives still in those same places. So some of our ancestors had to have been those people that he was purchasing from those auctions that day, or those at those different time periods.
So real quick, you mentioned Henry Lawrence. Is that the Henry Lawrence, I believe, that's connected to Lawrence?
I was gonna ask the same thing. Yes.
I believe that the county is named after
There's a
him.
connection,
Okay.
yeah. So what role did genetic genealogy play in the research that was conducted for your book? So, I'm loving that you're talking about connecting to DNA cousins and even internationally. But can you just share a little bit about how you use that in your book?
Right. So I guess once I got my DNA test back, I did see the DNA ethnicity report and all that. But then I went to the DNA matches. So I seen people that I knew and I grew up with, but I didn't know they took the test. But then there was also other people on my DNA matches. I didn't have an idea how we were related. But through further research, I ended up finding out that many of my DNA matches, we have a common ancestor on the plantations that I was researching. So like at one point I did get my grandmother to take the test because she, she's closer to those common ancestors than I am. So once she took the test, she showed she had more CMs with the people that I also shared. And then she also had other people that I, because I didn't inherit that piece of segment of DNA. But basically, genetic genealogy is one of the main reasons why I was able to pretty much find out who the other people were that were also on those plantations, because I would find their descendants on our DNA matches. And so that's probably, and actually in my acknowledgement, I acknowledge and I give thanks to everyone that took a DNA test in my family, because if it wasn't for their DNA test results, I wouldn't have been able to find other relatives, or at least let those relatives know, hey, your ancestors were enslaved on the same plantation with my ancestors. And so particularly with the Blake plantation side, there's a partition record from 1840. And it's over 1,000 people that the Blake family owned, and their names
Wow.
are recorded inside that partition record. And so I would let these people know, this is your ancestor inside this partition record.
Wow.
This is the reason why me and you share DNA, because somewhere down the line we have a common ancestor on this plantation. And then I was able to do the same thing with like Otaheite and Old Fort. And quite recently, I found at least, I believe, 10 DNA matches, and I know that they descend from people who were enslaved at Old Fort and Otaheite plantation. So genetic genealogy plays a big role, because I just don't talk about my ancestors in the book, but all the other people's ancestors, to tell that story.
Well, you really worked that genetic genealogy in there. You worked that muscle. That's good.
I think that's important too. Glad to hear you go into detail about it, because there are a lot of people that are just saying, "Oh, it doesn't matter. It's not. It's fake." It's not. And I'm sitting there going, "Oh, it matters to me because it answers so many questions for me." and just understanding, oh, well, you were here, but you moved there, and okay, what are you
Right.
guys doing there? It just let it opened up so many different avenues as far as research. So I'm glad to hear you say that, because I just don't understand how people are saying, like, oh, well, it's not real and it's fake and it's oh, for entertainment. Somebody actually said to me, and everybody's in the they're entitled to their opinions, but not the facts. And they said, well, it clearly states entertainment purpose. I was like, it can state whatever it wants to state. It has totally answered so many questions for me,
Yes, yeah.
how I'm connected to people, and you sharing your experience rather, and the results just inspires me even more. And I hope we'll do the same for our listeners.
Yeah, and then if I can add something else,
Absolutely.
like back to the Blake Plantation research, and I mentioned earlier that the relatives were split up once Arthur Blake purchased his plantation on the Santee River. And so during the Civil War, his plantation was raided by the Union Army, well, not the Union Army, by the South Atlantic Blockading Squadron. They landed some Marines and stuff on his plantation. They destroyed his dwelling house and rice mills and stuff like that. And they saved 400 people from the plantation. And so at the time, Beaufort was where majority of the refugees were being were brought to. And so that's how my ancestors from that side of the family got to Beaufort. They were saved during the Civil War. But whenever I will find these people on my DNA matches, so this is three counties that I'm talking about right now. The main plantation was in Colleton County. So that's where majority of the older people were born at. And then
Okay.
they were taken to the South Santee River, that's in Charleston County.
Okay.
Civil War, they were brought to Beaufort, that's in Beaufort County.
Got it.
Any of the descendants who live in Beaufort County, they have descendants on their DNA matches whose families were never sent to Santee. And those people still live in Colleton County. And so they probably never know, well, why I'm related to this person. I know how you related to these people. Y'all have a common ancestor. Your family was brought to Beaufort as refugees, but they originated in Colleton. And so, like, one of my cousin DNA matches, she shares 67 cm with this woman from Colleton. Her family enslaved at the Blake Plantation the entire time. They never met each other, don't know each other, but somewhere down the line, they have a common ancestor. And then I don't like to use my family as a example, because when my ancestors were brought back to Beaufort, they went back to Colleton. And so my third grandfather, his side of the family was actually remained on the Cumbie River in Colleton. And so I don't know if I'm related to some of these DNA matches through him, or I'm related through his wife, whose family was sent to Santee. So it's kind of hard for me, you know.
Yeah.
So, and then I believe I'm related to a lot of these people multiple ways. So we all
Right.
got
I'm
multiple.
sure you are. Yes. So you've got endogamy at play, you know.
Yeah,
So,
so a lot of endogamy.
yeah, Marion County, Florence, and Columbia. There is in Horry County, actually. There is so much of that, and a lot of it has to do with the smaller communities, especially Marion. You know, I make a joke, and I don't think, you know, I have some people go, why do you do us like that? But in Marion County, if you were born and raised there, go marry somebody out of the state, like a couple of states away, because in most cases, you're going to be related to somebody, and it is because of slavery. And you can look at the maps, and that's one thing I wanted to highlight in your book from the, you know, from what I read. I love the graphics. You use a lot of like the maps and the illustrations and all. And I think that's really, really helpful, you know, just rather than just texting somebody there, you show people your story or where they were and all. So I really like that. Appreciate that about the book. Yeah, and I, you know, as you were speaking, I you know, kind of underscored the point of something we say a lot, you know, the role that the broader history plays in understanding genealogy and how important it is to, you know, understand what was going on in that area, in that county, what was happening, so that you can put your family history into context, and then it can, you know, perhaps answer some questions that people have. You know, so I think what you just said was a perfect example of that. I also love the shout out that you said, the acknowledgement to people who took the DNA test, because I know for me, I was very surprised that my grandmother and her sister actually agreed to take a DNA test. I was like pretty sure they would say no and like shoot me down. But they actually say yes. And, it does really help, and it brings you closer to the common ancestors and brings that DNA information further than, you can go on your own. So that was really awesome.
Before you move on, just wanted to share this. So it's important not only to understand history, genealogy, but also understand DNA, and especially when you have communities where endogamy comes into play. So I'll give you an example of why I'm saying that. There was a young man, he took a DNA test, he got his parents to take a DNA test, and results came back. Everybody's matching. And so he called Ancestry, not Ancestry, I think it was 23andMe, and said, "You all made a mistake. This is not right." And he had them on the phone. I want to say they said it was approximately the person that was sharing the story, maybe 20 minutes fussing with them. And that the representative, I guess she was just like, "Okay, I give up." She's like, "It was a long time ago. It was a long time ago." But the reason that it was, he was just like, "My parents can't be related. That's not right. They can't be related."
It
But when you
happens.
understand community, right?
Exactly.
Community. And when you understand history
Exactly.
and slavery, like you get it. It's like it makes sense. I have cousins that are related to me four, five,
Yep.
seven, eight
And it
different
seems like
ways.
this is common in South Carolina because
Oh, yeah.
my other cousin, who is on two lines, one, okay, two different, same family in South Carolina, the Chitty line. One cousin is related to me twice, and we're not really sure how. And then another cousin said the same thing about Barnwell County. She's like, we don't date anyone from Barnwell County because that's kinfolk, and we just stay out of that. So I don't know, I guess it makes sense with that being sort of like, I hate to say heartbeat of plantation life, but in many ways it was kind of like a central nervous system, if you will. And people stayed there. And so it does make sense. And again, this goes to understanding the broader history and how people moved around and migration patterns or lack thereof.
Right.
So yeah.
Darius, you talked about three, well, several counties, right? And I love how you broke down, well, some here, some were refugees, right? And so for me, like, and I think this is important for people to understand with DNA and looking at all those results, sometimes it gets a little overwhelming. So I have DNA matches that are in Mississippi, Alabama. I'm still working through South Carolina and Rhode Island, or South Carolina and Connecticut and Virginia and North Carolina. I haven't even made it to those matches that I have, and some of them are fairly, close matches. It's like, well, who went to Mississippi? Like, who was sold south? All of these matches in Louisiana. Well, who went to Louisiana? So I think it's important not to get overwhelmed with the DNA part of it. And so, before we move to the next one, I just wanted to ask, like, do you try to figure out all of them? I don't think we've ever asked anybody that question. Or do you work, like, I work with, say, first to fourth or fifth. I find that like higher is a little challenging. So
Her
with your
cousin, you
DNA
mean?
matches, like, is there a cutoff as far as cousins? Like, is there a cutoff for you, or you just go for everybody, depending on where they are?
Yeah, I guess I go for, but when I was doing the research, I was targeting certain people. So the way that I was doing it, I was using some people as a proxy, because I know. So, like, for example, I'm just going to use the Blake Plantation research again. I was using some people as a proxy because I know their entire family trees came from that one plantation. And so whenever I was finding people from here in Beaufort who was matching them, I know, okay, somewhere in their tree, they got an ancestor from that plantation. Then I would do the research and do the research. Then I would find, okay, my family matched them too. Then I end up finding a pension file and finding the person ancestor testifying. Oh yeah, I know this person all my life. We came from Santee on the gunboats. Okay, that's the reason why they matching these people in Colleton County. So I would use some people as a proxy. That's the way I was using my DNA matches. And it doesn't really matter to me if it's in the first, the second cousin range, or the third to fourth cousin range.
As far as what is it, fifth to eighth?
Yeah, fifth to eighth, fifth cousin to eighth cousin and stuff like that. Yeah, and then so like with my grandmother, she has this DNA match. They share like 145 CMs. Now that lady,
Whoa. Wow.
her entire family tree goes back to the Blake Plantations in Colleton County. I'm at the great great grandparents' generation level for my grandmother and this woman, but they don't have a common ancestor yet. And so that's how I'm figuring that they probably have multiple sets of common ancestors, and so they're getting double amount of the DNA.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
They don't have a common ancestor yet, and it's 145 cms. And so that's why I was saying the low country of South Carolina, everyone is connected, all of the counties, Beaufort County, Colleton County, Charleston County, Georgetown, Jasper County at one point was part of Beaufort County. It was created in 1912. But these places are very interconnected because many of the slave owners, they had multiple plantations. So like with the Pinckney family, they had a plantation in Beaufort called Pinckney Island. Then they had another one on Port Royal Island, where my family lives near at now. Then they had one on the Santee River in Charleston. So now you got family members being separated. One brother, he's sent to the plantation in Beaufort. The other brother, he remained back in Charleston County. After the Civil War, they don't see each other no more. They're going by different surnames. Now you got in different places, and that's how it is. And in the low country, many of the slave owner families have multiple plantations, and people get moved around.
Okay, so to that point, okay, I'll make this quick. So there was a gentleman that I went to high school with, and we were very, very close, and we're really, really good friends. So he comes home, he went to the Navy, and he comes home, we would go and we would hang out. And so I remember one time he tried to give me a little hug, whatever. I was like, no. I just stopped. He was like, "Well, what's the problem?" And I said, "Well, we're good friends. Like, we're good friends." And I never thought anything else of it. And we stayed in touch. And now you're talking over close to 40 years, right? And so I'm doing the research, and I see his last name pop up. So I keep doing the research, and I would ask him, "What are the names of your grandparents and your great grandparents?" And he was like, "Well, I know the grandparents." It's like, "I'll get it to you, whatever." He would never get it. So finally, I was like, "Enough is enough." I was like, "I need you to give me the name of your grandparents and great grandparents." And lo and behold, we're related. Okay. And he was like, "Well, how is that? My family's from North Carolina. Your family's from South Carolina." I said, "Give me an hour." Did some research and realized that the plantation owner, my family's from South Carolina, inherited property in North Carolina. Took some of his enslaved people with him. They took the surname Bellamy. Doing the research, a lot of people out there have done research. I did my own. So our ancestors are connected. And he was just like, wow. So that speaks to your point about you, like you stay with South Carolina, but you got, and that's my situation. We have South Carolina, Horry County, and then this person is going to North Carolina. I forget what county it is. But then people are like all over the place. Some people did, there were a lot of slave owners that didn't even live in the same state, and they had somebody else managing their plantations. So for Sharicana, one of the main surnames is Woodruff. Well, why am I talking to a genealogy colleague that lives in Connecticut, lives in Massachusetts, and we're talking and I'm telling him about Sharicana's successful story that she got the record pension file for. He goes, "Well, we have Woodruffs in Connecticut." I was like, this is too much. So sometimes with genealogy, like and the research and the things that happen, and I believe in now more so than ever in collaborative genealogy, having conversations like, "Hey, who, which ancestor are you re researching? Well, where were they from?" Sharon Khan and I even had, and not to get too far from the book, but one day I was doing some research, and one of my ancestors. One of my cousins, her husband has Chiricana's ancestor, the one that she was looking for the pension file, in their record. And I was just looking at the computer screen. I was like, let me just turn it off and turn it back on again because I'm not seeing, And we met at a genealogy group, and here it is. One of my cousins, her husband, has Chiricana's ancestor in their family tree. So to me, like genealogy history, DNA is like the coolest thing ever. And if I could do it like full time, I would because I'm like, it's so many ancestors. It's just so many of them.
And then to piggyback on that, like Savannah, Georgia, Savannah is kind of like an extension of South Carolina. Everybody in South Carolina has family in Savannah. But going back in time, many of the slave owners in the low country, South Carolina, had a plantation in Savannah too. So Daniel Blake, he owned a plantation on the Ogeechee River. And so I have a bunch of DNA matches. Their family trees can be traced back to his plantation on the Geechee River. So we, and then through further research, I ended up finding out that many of the people from the Cumbie River were taken to Savannah. And then several of the planters, they had a plantation in North Carolina in Buncombe County and in Henderson County. They would build summer vacation homes because during the summer months, that was one of the worst times for many of the planters. And so they would go to like Buncombe County, North Carolina. And so I would target, like I would go on my DNA matches and see, well, I would type in Buncombe County to see if I got some relatives there. So I remember like one of the pension files, this guy, his name was William B. Murray, and he talks about how before the war, he grew up with his cousin Richard, and Richard was sent up to Santee, and he was sent up to North Carolina, and that he didn't see him again till after the war. And he talks about how he went on the boat that went to Hilton Head, and that's when he saw his cousin for the first time, and he saw his aunt for the first time because they had been separated.
About yo man, what's up?
Wow,
That feeling. Okay,
that's
so
beautiful.
you said Savannah, right? So I tried. I tried. Okay. You know, I accept full responsibility, for this interview being what it is right at this point. So Savannah, Google Books. I get this the nudge. Put this ancestor in Google Books. Why not? I'm not I'm working on that. Put this ancestor's name in Google Books. I do. And page comes up from the AME Zion church where they interviewed pastors. And my ancestor was interviewed because I was wondering, I'm like, why do we have these Hannah ancestors with the last name Hannah? What are our Hannah ancestors doing in Savannah? And the answer was in the Google Books document and
Wow.
basically talks about his father passing away and he lived with the family and they moved, it was his cousins and all. And they decided after the Civil War was over that they were going to Savannah because they could work and make more money. And their goal was to go back to Africa. So if you're going back to Africa, somebody had to know exactly where you came from to say, I'm going back there. So more than likely, it was probably Liberia or Sierra Leone. So talks about that. They founded schools in Savannah, churches that still exist in Savannah. I'm like, wow. Now, South Carolina, Lincolnville. I'm driving. We're driving to Charleston to the museum, and I see Lincolnville. I'm like, well, now we got another stop in Lincolnville because the ancestor that I talked about that was a Freedmen's Bureau teacher, that's where he settled. How did I know he settled there? He found out that one of the teachers that he had was still alive in Connecticut and wrote a letter. And what did they do? They put the letter in the newspaper, and the letter was about his entire life and why he was in Lincolnville. And if you know Lincolnville, which is right there next to Charleston, only like less than 10, 15 minutes away, Lincolnville was established by formerly enslaved people, and they named it after Abraham Lincoln. And so, in the dark, Saturday night, I'm driving, like I'm going to Lincolnville and I'm going to go to the church. I think it's Ebenezer Church, and was able to stop there and visit. And then, the last place, and this is only because you mentioned vacationing and their summer homes, I'm trying to figure out why are people in Rhode Island coming to South Carolina? And that's it. They would vacation during the winter months in Rhode Island. In South Carolina, which reveals like further, provided like an avenue for me to do further research about my ancestors who were Native American and their enslavers. Well, some of them were free, but some of them were enslaved, going back and forth from Rhode Island to South Carolina. Okay.
So, Darius, what do you want the takeaway to be for people who will read your book?
So I guess I would want them to take away. So my book is kind of centered around 1861. I believe many African Americans don't know that it was people freed that early. So we had to learn about
Right.
1863 or 1865, and then quite recently, many of us celebrating Juneteenth, the African Americans who were freed later on in Texas, and so. I kind of show how my ancestors were freed at the Battle of Port Royal. That happened on November 7th, 1861. And so when the slave owners fled, they left all the black people behind. And that's how the Port Royal experiment and all that stuff comes into play. But I also want people to realize that our ancestors were resilient. They weren't, pushover. They were just more than picking cotton or in the rice fields and stuff like that. Slavery was about extracting resources out of people. We were so much more. We were carpenters and bricklayers, and something else that I've been looking at more recently is many African Americans were working on ships during slavery, sailors and stuff like that. I see a lot of that in estate inventories and stuff, and so I don't want no one to be ashamed about their enslaved ancestors. I guess you can be comfortable with your history, you know. We don't have to be anyone else. Just be comfortable with being black and stuff like that. So that's my takeaway.
Right, because you didn't go get people that didn't know
Boom.
what to do. You went to get people that knew how to cultivate rice, indigo, skilled builders, riding around Charleston. I'm like, anything that you see here that's old, the enslaved people, and I,
Built
like I
that.
said,
Did
people
that.
built it. You knew
Absolutely.
exactly what you were doing. So lazy,
Shiftless.
ignorant, no. And then for them to learn how to communicate when the language is taken away, to still learn how to communicate and say what you want them to say, the best way that they knew how. That's why I never make fun of Gullah Geeching. I had the cousins that, they had that very choppy language. And, my husband would say sometimes, he's like, how do you understand that? He said, because I grew up around and I have an ear, I can understand it. So, but I don't think that we have the right to make fun of our family or ancestors that spoke that way, And when I say choppy language, I'll give you an example. So I had a cousin and he said, they may contact phone for you, she wanted to call her. And I knew exactly what he said. And it just, to other people, it just sounded like that, 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 that. And I said, okay. And a person standing next to me said, what did he say? I said, he said, Daisy May called on the telephone for you. She wants you to call her. This was before cell phones. He was like, how do you understand that? I said, because I grew up with it. And then the other thing is, like, when I come to visit my family and I'm comfortable with them, because I lived there until I was 13, and we get start laughing and talking. There is a, well, I already talked most. I did have one person, I was doing a presentation one time. He said, you talk really fast. I need you to slow down. I'm sorry. I don't mean. So I have to work on that. But that is a part of me coming from South
Dialects.
Carolina, and you get excited and you start talking real fast and everything. And I do it. And I just, is it acclimate? I just fall right into it and I can do it. I get very loud with them because they're free. My South Carolina folks are some free folks, right? And words sound like they're made up words, but I understand it and I respect it. Now, I had a cousin from Beaufort. Forget it. I couldn't keep up. I couldn't keep up and I could not understand it because it was
Why
like,
it's faster or something?
it was faster and very, I was like, no, I got nothing.
Yeah, so when I was younger, me and my mom, we lived in Atlanta, Georgia, right on the outskirts in several places. But when I first moved there, I had to repeat myself a lot because they thought I was from Jamaica. But over time, my accent, got watered down and stuff. And so that's something else that I would have people to be comfortable in your speech and stuff like that.
I think the accent that it often gets compared to is Barbados, is the Bajan accent and the Gullah Geechee accent.
And then at the time, many people that didn't know. So when I would tell people I was from South Carolina, they go, oh no, ain't no way. I got family from South Carolina. Well, maybe they're from Greenville or something. I've
It depends on what part.
my family from the islands in South Carolina.
There's a difference. So, Darius, in closing, what are some parting words? We talked about the takeaway, but what are some parting words that you would like to share with our listeners?
Well, I guess I would say, research your family tree, cherish the moments that you have with your elders, and make sure that you pick their brains. That's what I did, and I was always listening, and it's a lot I can say, but that's genealogy is very addicting if you're going to get into it. So if you believe that you're going to start for maybe a day or a week or so, it might latch on to you like it did to me.
Last one too. I like that. I like that.
I was going to be doing this full time at the museum and stuff like that, but genealogy is very important. We need to know about our family history so that we can pass that information on down to the next generation.
That's right. Well, Darius, thank you so much for sharing with us and our listeners. Please let our listeners know how they can find out more about you and your new book.
Oh, so my book is available right now on Amazon and Barnes and Noble, and it is also located on online on Google Play. Yeah.
And give our listeners the title of your book one more time.
At the Feet of the Elders, A Journey into a Low Country Family History.
Love it. We thank you for joining us, and we look forward to sharing with you during our next segment of Speak On It.
Speak On It is a podcast and is immediately available to listen to at your leisure. Thank you.